tell the Rebbe the words
Love
of the new song
radio.
We're singing with the Shia, right? I'm just going to read him. Am Yisrael, have no fear. Mashiach will be here this year. We want Mashiach now. We don't want to wait. Okay?
Yes, blessed souls, blessings and greetings, greetings and blessings. You're tuned in live now to blogtalkradio.com, and we humbly suggest with a higher frequency. We are called Soul Class, and this happens to be Soul Class 608 in discussion with Distinguished B'nai Noah, Part 5. And we're blessed to stay alive in Torah Chaim, instructions of life, Torah Chesed, instructions of kindness, Torah Rachim, instructions of mercies. Baruch Hashem, blessed is our Creator, Shalom, peace, and Baruch, a blessing upon the entire human family experience. With Creator's help, we're now broadcasting live at 10:32 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, live from Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA, Unifying Soul Actualization. Today's program content will focus on dialoguing with distinguished B'nai Noach, children of Noah, concerning quality of education as it relates to a goal set forth by the United Nations in 2015. This series is also in connection to my being inspired by a new Facebook closed group, which I think has reached over 280 members, called 7 plus 3, Chassidus Chabad for Yeshivas B'nai Avraham, which will hopefully be an open forum to 7 billion plus human souls all blessed with a divine image. Our call-in number is 347-838-8669. Meanwhile, may the Eternal Creator bless and protect you and your loved ones. The tags for today's program are Eternal Creator, Divine Creator, Universal Redemption, and Children of Israel collaborating with Children of Noah, working on eradicating hatred, jealousy, and competition, which is not needed. With that being said, I also want to dedicate today's humble efforts towards the elevation of the soul of my father, Rav Shlomo Yaakov ben Chuna David, who passed on April 17th of this year, which corresponds to the 9th of Nisan, 5,776 years since Adam and Eve, our common ancestors, walked and served God upon this blessed earth. Joining me today are, in fact, two quite distinguished B'nai Noach. Number one is, not an important system just because he called in first, is author and B'nai Noach Torah scholar, Alan W. Cecil. Alan has authored Secular by Design, A Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances. And also we have Ben Noah scholar and activist Ron Williams, who has been a close student, Rabbi Yaakov Rogalski, who co-authored The Path of the Rosh Gentile with Rabbi Chaim Klorfin. Good morning, Alan and Ron, and Ron and Alan.
Good morning.
Good morning, Alan and Don.
Unfortunately, I just got a message from Brad Arner, who is also a Ben Noah scholar, that he's unable to participate today. Hopefully, we'll figure out when we'll reconvene with this program. So basically, there were 17 goals set out by the United Nations in 2015. I'll just enumerate them quickly, and we'll focus on the one which is the topic of today's discussion. 17 goals, which I don't think are in any way an antithesis to the spirit and the actual implementation in a practical fashion of the seven Noahide commandments. No poverty, zero hunger, good health and well-being, quality education, gender equality, clean water and sanitation, affordable and clean energy, decent work and economic growth. Number 9 is in industry, innovation, and infrastructure. 10 is reduced inequalities. 11, sustainable cities and communities. 12, responsible consumption and protection. 13, climate action. 14, life below water. 15, life on land. 16, peace, justice, and strong institutions. 17, partnerships for the goals. So, with that being said, Alan, of these 17 goals, which happens to add up to the Gematria of Tov, we're focusing in today on the idea of education, which is of a certain quality, a quality education. Now, I don't know if that's always been the norm for the human film experience, because there have been movements in human civilization where there was obviously efforts to squash the dissemination of knowledge for certain segments of a population. Well, the upper crust, the upper echelon, the 1%ers or 5%ers or 25%ers, whatever you want to call it, the 50%ers, have had access to proper education. So your take on this, why this idea of quality education for all human beings is totally in sync with the spirit of the seven Noahide commandments?
Well, it's in sync with it. The problem is, if anyone who knows the history of the United Nations, particularly in the last 40 years, they have passed resolution after resolution against Israel. Any education system, and I wrote about this in my book, that excludes Torah is an education system that is incomplete. And the problem that I see, I am all for this, I agree with it 100%, but unless the knowledge of the Torah and the seven Noahide laws is included in this education system, I don't see how it's going to help, because there has been a lot, the last 100, 150 years or so since we've had public schooling, more people have been, education has been available to more people. You got the internet. You can look up anything now. But until the Noahide laws are included in this educational system, because, the other things you talked about poverty and justice and stuff, until there is no system that can compare to the Torah about making society a better society and making it work. And I feel without that included in this system, it's not going to work out.
Mm-hmm. Ron?
I recently had the privilege to deal with a yeshiva student, and I asked him his curriculum, what does he study on an average day? And, he's already the age of bar mitzvah, so he has happening in the morning when he gets in there, and then his academic studies of math, English, science, and they also have the learning of course, Hebrew, because, the obligation, he has to read the Torah and his prayers are in Hebrew, but also that has Gemara studies, and I immediately I parallel with my education and, in terms of spiritual and academic. And back home, we didn't have a religious school setting per se, but we prayed in the morning. And we had a general prayer where we all stood up and we prayed, the entire class. And then we would break for lunch. When we returned at 1 o'clock to continue the afternoon session, we would pray then too. And then at afternoon, we would also have prayers. I honestly don't know the origin of the prayers, and what was the mandate, the actual, they were Christian prayers, obviously. But we pray that we have a safe trip home in the afternoons and a good night and to return to school next day. So we had a prayer system set up in our school.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I hear you.
You know, coming here and seeing that everything is so secularized and, you know, religion and faith, everything is so, like, divided. And we being a creation of both spiritual and physical at the same, simultaneously, and both have to be addressed. And in a school setting, it really gave you a sense of a communal feeling of our belief in a higher authority of something outside of the just the main academic studies. And it was something I kind of missed from my nephew and niece who attend the public school here in America.
Mm-hmm. I hear you. With that being said,
hello?
I'd like to go. Yeah, hello. I can hear you. I can hear both
hello?
Of you.
Hello.
Yes, Alan.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah. Everyone's Ron. Can you? You said Ron. I guess Ron lost us. Hopefully, we'll call back in a moment. So we'll just continue, Alan, till Ron will call back. Okay. With that being said, something I've mentioned on previous programs, and I will probably mention it future programs. That the let me just bring Ron back in. Ron?
Hello, yes.
Yeah, okay, we lost you. We got you back. Baruch Hashem.
What?
Okay, with that being said, Ron, I'm going to mention something that I've talked about in previous programs and hope I will probably not shy away from mentioning in future programs. The Lubavitch Rebbe once told the former mayor, actually he's passed on as well, John Lindsay, in the late 1960s, and he was teaching a Sunday morning class, and I forgot which denomination he was of Christianity, and the Rebbe advised him to teach Proverbs. Now, Proverbs are basically it's 31 chapters, I thought maybe there's a 32nd, 31 chapters of allegorical instruction, but some of it can be pretty literal as well, and I want to zoom in on if we are really going to focus in, of course, taking it as a granted that Torah teachings will be integrated into international educational systems, whether they want to secularize it or they want to philosophize it. I mean, we don't want it to turn into a religion because we've talked many times, the seven Noahic commandments are not a religion. They are instructions for life. And I'm going to pull out from chapter 22, verse 6, which is a very important teaching, and I'd like you guys, gentlemen, both to comment on it. But, and I'm also, before I ask you to comment, I'm going to read the verse and bring in Rashi's commentary on it. The verse goes like this. In chapter 22, verse 6, King Solomon wrote, "Train a child according to his way. Even when he grows old, he will not turn away from it." So there's three things here going on. Training the child according to his or her way, and as he or she matures, they will not turn away from that instruction. Now Rashi, or actually the Metzudat David, who is another classical commentator in the Oral Torah tradition, actually Rashi comments first. Let me say this. Where it says train a child, Rashi says, according to what you teach a child and train him in manners, either good or bad, even when he grows old, he will not turn away from it. So Metzudat David mentions, accustom a child to perform God's servant's service according to his intelligence. Then even when he grows old, he will not turn away from it, for he will put his mind to understand the advantage of these deeds. Now the Meiri, another classic commentator, also explains the verse in this manner, that King Solomon exhorts the father to train his child according to his age, what a child of that age can grasp. Then he will not turn away from that training even in his old age. Mary also suggests, will you train a child according to his way? Even when he grows old, he will not turn away from it. Will you really train a child according to his way and his whims without disciplining him? If you do so, he will never leave his childish ways even when he grows old. So the Meiri responds and then questions. But the point I want to bring out, the first question I want to ask Alan and turn to Ron is, Alan, that first approach and relating to education that King Solomon is turning to the parents of children, saying, This teaching should be looked as a form of dedication on the part of the parent. It's not something. It's not a rote, antiquated statute. Oh, send your kids to school. But you should be dedicated towards the education of your child. And I lament over the fact that, unfortunately, parents are, so to speak, throwing their children, and even it exists to some extent in the yeshiva system, that they're saying, well, I'm too busy to teach my child. We'll leave it in the hands of others. But if the child doesn't sense that the parent values the education of them at a tiny age, more likely than not, the child is going to start to wander from what they're supposed to be dedicated to because they don't see the mother or father being dedicated towards their education. And can you see this as being a problem also among the B'nai Noach, Dan, Alan?
Well, absolutely, because, you know, I've known personally many Jews who grew up in a quote-unquote religious household who later turned to other religions, atheism, what have you, probably
yes.
for the very reason you named. So, yes, it could be a problem. And the same thing I've heard from countless Christians, people who grew up in a Christian family who left all religion behind as they got older. Same thing. The parents have to be dedicated. The things that are taught need to be taught where, as they get older, they see the wisdom of it and will want to continue in the pursuit. You have to teach them a bunch of things, you know, when they get older and they learn, they encounter other ideas, other philosophies, other religions, and say, well, you know, this is just as good as anything else or better. They're not going to stay in that path. So I agree that the parents have to be dedicated, not just how they teach, but what they teach.
Mm-hmm. Ron, how can we promote the idea? And now we're talking about children of all ages, because there are some people who are in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s who have the Torah knowledge, whether they be Jews or B'nai Noach. How can we exemplify to them that getting the information is not just for the sake of getting knowledge, but it's to dedicate oneself towards a higher ends and a higher means of serving God and fellowshipping with other people and empowering other people?
First of all, hello?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
First of all, I have to say my grandmother passed away at the age of 98 years old. And up until just before that, when I spoke to her, and we would talk about belief in God and everything, she would still recall the knowledge she acquired from hearing her father mentioning, actually educating her in the ways of the Bible when she was a small child, because he passed away when she was just a teenager. So he didn't live on to really continue educating her in terms of, you know, constant strengthening her belief in God, but that belief that seed he planted when she was a small child, she said he would come and he would sit in bed with her and he would tell her all the stories of the Bible. That is what she credited her whole belief in God until the day she passed. So I think what it is an underestimation when parents don't realize that they actually given a present. An opportunity of cultivating such a foundation in a small child, even before they enter the kindergarten, before they enter school. Whatever we say to
right.
them is like a first tradition we pass verbally into their mind. And should we hold on to this for the rest of our lives? And most grown-ups, you talk to them, they can recall their childhood so clear, so vivid, and the things that were ingrained in them at that time. Take such a prominent role in the decision making and everything that they do, including their faith and belief in God. If they take a second to look back, my gosh, you know, my belief came from my mother sitting at night telling me this, or my father, then they would realize the importance of him giving this over to their children.
Mm-hmm.
So this is my take on that.
Yeah, I would like to mention that something that I grew up with, and something that I tried, you know, for some reason I didn't originally do it, and then I was advised to do it. I guess I forgot from the time I was a little child to when I became a parent myself, is one of the things that you can draw your young child's heart when they're one, when they're two, when they're three, four, you know, the age when they can sit on your lap, your son or your daughter, is to read to them books. And, of course, in the beginning, when a child can't really recognize the ABCs, or if it's in Hebrew, the Aleph, Beis, Gimel, Dalet, the fact that you have taken them and nestled them on your knee, and you might even give a little covert hugging, or they could feel the support of their backside against, you know, your chest cavity, and you have an arm over their shoulder gently, and you carefully guide them through the reading, and you speak to them softly and gently and sweetly. Basically, it's kind of like I hate to say it, but I will say, just for the sake of, since we're talking on an allegorical form here, within the context of the teachings of King Solomon in Proverbs, it's a Pavlovian type of stimulation. So a child's earliest remembrances of first learning to look at a book is being nurtured by a loving parent, or it could be a sibling, it could be a grandparent, it could be an aunt or uncle. And this is something that also that will stay with them, the sense of security, the sense of support they're getting as they are now associating the world through a more limited perspective, through focusing on, you know, two pages of an open book, whether it be with pictures or simple letters or just identifying the alphabet or the alphabet. Alan, your take on these matters, how we, you know, a child at such a young age, when they're kind of, so to speak, fresh paper, how we can inculcate with them a sense of feeling special in the process of wanting to adhere to a new type of perception, the perception which can be transmitted so uniquely through books.
And that is such a unique way to do it. Being able to read the thoughts and ideas of someone who might have passed away centuries before. And as you said, that it's a special bonding moment. I've raised four children myself, all who consider themselves to varying degrees as Noahide. And and now I have grandchildren who are being taught about the Noahide laws. So
beautiful.
This is something, you know, yeah, we've got three generations now of Noahides in our family. So this is something that I agree with that we should do, being able to read to your children. And like you said, the Pavlovian kind of attachment to it, you know, as long as they don't drool on the Torah, then, you know, it is a very positive thing. I agree.
Mm-hmm. So, with that being said, Ron, your take on these matters as well.
Oh, that's how I that was my connection to my mom. She would sit and read with me and all the stories, and I'm 48 years old, basically in a few months I'll be 48, and of all those years, those stories that my mom read to me never left my mind. They're all in there. So I understand the importance of it. And this is what I hope to give over also to my descendants, hopefully.
Yep. I don't remember exactly, but I remember being read a story about a little Indian boy called Sammy who would go into the woods, and it was warned by my parents, be careful of the tiger, he'll eat you. And he went to a tree and ran around a tree until the tiger became a little rivulet of milk, and his one of his parents or his grandparents, they turned the milk of the tiger into the milk for his pancakes. And I remember being, yeah. And also I had an affinity for whales, blue whales. So I remember my parents getting me books for whales and on whales, and taking me to the Museum of Natural History in New York City and seeing that colossal, you know, model of a blue whale. So that. And I just also want to say that growing up in my house, even though my father and mother didn't have as many books as me, I noticed that, you know, it just is a natural part of a household to have a collection of books. And in particular, my father's collection of books was that it was used for one's livelihood. And he used to tell me, not in a way of lecturing, just saying as a matter of fact, that if I don't keep up with the field that I'm in, which was the field of mechanical engineering, that he would be out of work. In fact, he told me that if he did not increase his knowledge from the time that he'd earned his master's degree to like 7-8 years later, he would have been out of the job, because even at the high level of master degree work that he did at Rensselaer Polytech College, that the mathematics had become, from the 1950s, became obsolete by the 1960s. So much had mathematics advanced in the field of electrical engineering. So again, too, a child who is given a sense of growing with a new way of perceiving the world through the written letter, which hopefully they will, he or she will internalize that it's time to grow throughout life through, you know, reading letters in a book. I mean, of course, today you have, for people who are tired, they have MP3. You can listen to a lecture in Torah on any subject matter. You can watch a video on YouTube. But when I watch these things, I find that there comes a point in the middle of listening to the lecture, and I guess it's so I'm not surprised if people leave the lectures that we or the programs we have, that there comes a point where, see, if it's a book, then you can stop and return and review the material and internalize it, and you can write it down, you can ask a question, you can answer it, maybe you can't answer the question that's come up in your mind. You know, it's a relationship just as much as having a conversation with a live human being. Of course, we're not going to say books will replace the conversations with human beings. But a book, as Alan said, what other experience can you have here in this world, some from a prophetic experience, which 99.99% of the human race has not or will not experience, that you can have an interaction with a wise person from 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years ago. And with all the great technology that we have today, we're still talking about those people of ancient days, Noah and Adam and Chanuk and Esau and King David and Samuel and just a host of human beings who are such great neshamas, great souls, that you can grow with them, even though you've never met them.
Something quick to that?
Yeah, yes, Ron, I'm sorry.
It just hit me really hard. You know, when a child is at that age and all they have is a pure innocence, and I think it really, really rests on the parents to take that innocence and direct it in the right way and mold it and shape it. Because when we leave them, you know, they put small children in front of a television and they watch this, and after a while, this is the mode of which they understand and learn and acquire, and their minds are more susceptible to all this outside influence as opposed to when parents take that responsibility of basically directing, guiding that influence, even from on a subconscious level of the child, where eventually that child listens to their parents, they obey the parents with to a greater extent. Not so much obey, but they accept their parents' guidance easier because they've been raised like this, as opposed to constantly in front of a television. And I think this is one of the problems we're having here now in America with children, you know, parents being at such odd ends and they need constant therapy and counseling, is because I don't think parents, I mean, I don't blame parents because I know right now with the time, we are just basically out of time. All of our lives, we just seem to be chasing time. But I think it leads to much larger problems later on of communication between parents and children, and outside influences having such a strong hold on young children. And I think because we set that in motion when we place them in front of a television, we basically say, here, this will teach you, or you will learn from this. And we just step back and we're busy with whatever we're doing. We're on the phone or we're busy working or on whatever it is. Because the reason why I'm contrasting this against my upbringing is because we didn't have television. We had nothing else in the house. You sat with your parents. So your parents would talk to you, they would read to you, or we would just converse. And as a result, you get, this is who you listen to.
You have a problem. The first thing you run to your parents to ask, what should you do? You know, so that's just my addition now. Just hit me, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, gentlemen, I'd like to widen the context of this verse, this one verse in chapter 22, verse 6, and deal with the next three verses that follow. And hopefully that will take us to the conclusion of our program and how it relates to quality education or the lack of. Chapter 22, verse 7 in Proverbs talks about a rich man will rule over the poor and a borrower is a slave to a lender. Now, again, remember, this is Mishle. This is Proverbs. We're not just talking about a class warfare type of attitude, because from within the Torah context, because this is Torah, this is not poetry, this is not creative writing, this is not philosophical conjecture. These are matters that King Solomon was able to share with us because he had Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration, and of course, Ruach HaNevuah, the spirit of prophecy. So Rashi explains is that an ignoramus always needs a Torah scholar, and Metzudah David will say, who is rich? Someone who is rich in Torah will always rule over those who are in poor in knowledge, and that's from the Metzudah David. And a bower is a slave to a lender, just as a bower is subservient to a lender because he lends him what he needs, so is one who is poor in knowledge subservient to a scholar because he needs him for words of wisdom, from Metzudah David. Now, I want to clarify something. If someone is so rich in knowledge and ruling over those who are poor in knowledge, we're not trying to promote a class system in Torah knowledge. Meaning, if a person is rich and they go in the true Mosaic tradition of Moses, and Moses was likened to a candle who actually ignited the knowledge and spirituality of the 70 elders, and said that when a candle lights other candles, it doesn't lose its flame. So the idea of ruling over those who are poor in knowledge is not a type of oppressive, cultural, theological system, but rather it's just a matter of fact that a person who feels rich when they are enlivened by the knowledge of Torah, and ruling is meant to guide, not to oppress. Now, again, and this is unfortunately when people will look at this verse without the oral Torah tradition, they will say, okay, well, this shows you that, that's the way things are. But again, the borrower who is subservient to a lender, as Metzudah David said, one should acknowledge one is poor knowledge, and going to a scholar is to unshackle you from your sense of mental, cognitive, emotional slavery to misperceptions of such a, even just a simple verse of this. If a person does not learn the oral Torah tradition of Proverbs, Mishle, they are totally missing what King Solomon had intended upon. And this is one of the reasons why, just looking at the Seven Commandments without learning the oral Torah traditions, people are running around saying, oh, it's a plot by the Bnei Noach and the Jews to chop everyone's head off. I'm sure you're acutely aware of that, Alan, and any comments on these matters?
Yeah, one of the things that I bring out in my book, Secular by Design, is that ideally what the Torah teaches and what the Noahides are supposed to structure is a classless society.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it shows how some of the greatest sages and the most honored sages, people like Rabbi Hillel, were in fact very poor.
That's
yet
right.
They have so much honor because of their knowledge. I can't think of any group of people, and this is one of the major themes of my book, that are so poor in Torah knowledge than the intellectuals and academics of our current society. And this is something that, you know, what you were talking about, who is rich, who is poor, so many people, it's like being fed, you know, there's so much knowledge out there, but if the knowledge is the equivalent of Coke and French fries, you know, look at all the French fries I have, it's not going to sustain you. One thing I wanted to point out what we were talking about a little earlier in the Perkei Avot, in the first chapter of Perkei Avot, verse 6, it says,
yes.
Accept a teacher upon yourself, acquire a friend for yourself, and judge everybody favorably. And Rashi,
mm-hmm.
on acquire a friend for yourself, Rashi suggests that the Mishnah means that one should acquire books, as they are the best companions and are essential for acquiring Torah knowledge.
And Rashi wrote that even before, that was 300 years or 400
years
before the Gutenberg.
Almost 1,000
press.
Years ago. Yeah, that was almost 1,000
right.
years ago.
Where to own a book was or to write a book was really out of the norm in those days. And yet Rashi
yeah.
was already, I guess he foresaw how precious a book would be. Ron, your
mm-hmm.
take on these matters. Ron?
Hello, yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, your take. Yeah, okay,
yes,
I can hear you perfectly.
Okay. No, I personally think that you have to acquire a teacher for yourself, because you can't all assume that you will understand and know everything on your own, and even the way in which you understand it is pretty subjective. And, I think it is part of us also, the one who's wise is the one who learns from everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So a learning experience is something that you experience constantly and every day, but you have to be open to it. The minute you assume that you know everything or there's nothing to learn, that's the point when you start descending into total ignorance. I have this habit of constantly, buying books in terms of the Torah ontology or any book that deals with the seven guidelines and commandments. But many times what I would do is I would run it also by Rabbi Rogovsky even to assess if I've acquired it in the way in which it's according to Torah. And not just coming from, a secular perspective. Back to this verse here in Proverbs, and it says, the rich will marry the ruler for the poor. Unfortunately, in this country, I think it's been used as the lure for people to come here because they assume they become wealthy. And unfortunately, some people are just looking for this opportunity to be able to be in the state of a class of being a ruler. And not understanding
mm-hmm.
that when you become wealthy, you're actually just being a conduit to help those who are poor, not just to rule over them. And like you said, a lack of knowledge will create this type of ideas, which ultimately does not fare well in our human existence.
Mm-hmm. Ron, you're touching on points that we'll be talking about in brief in verse 8 and 9 of Proverbs. Chapter 22, verse 9. So, again, if we've not trained a child according to his or her way, so then when he or she grows older, he or she will not turn away from it. But let's say a person has got a poor education, but yet has climbed the social ladder of economic prosperity. Look what King Solomon has to say. He who sows injustice will reap violence, and the rod of his wrath will fail. So Rashi comments on the verse, he who sows injustice will reap violence, which is basically justice is, in fact, one of the seven Noahic commandments, law, systems of justice and mishpat. Rashi says, according to his sowing will be his reaping. According to his deed will be the reception of his reward. And again, this is where, again, one must interact with the oral Torah traditions, because where it says, and the rod of his wrath will fail, that Rashi comments, what we're talking about is not the rod of a stick, not the rod of some sort of tool or instrument of protection for the upper echelon of society, but we're talking about the rod of his ear of grain will fall more and more. And some say, okay, when a person gets into a position of rulership, the rod of his wrath, which he rules over people, will become progressively lessened because he impairs his ability. Cruelty impairs the ability of a human being to rule over other people. The intention is that, and this is from Rabbeinu Yonah, the intention is that if a wealthy man treats the poor over whom he rules, profiting through usury, which means interest, relying on the fact that the poor fear him, he will ultimately reap violence and lose his money, thus being paid in kind for his sins. He will lose his control over the poor as they feared him only because of his wealth. Now look what's happening here in this country, blessed souls. Now, we don't necessarily have a ruler in the form of a king, and this is really not something about President Obama and his policies, but the overall economic outlook of this land, if so many people are being oppressed through excessive interest on loans, whether they should have taken them or not, that's another issue. But we see that as well, that overall there are broadcasts and projections of a further, I mean, God forbid it shouldn't happen, of a further spiraling down of our economy. And we see that the minions of people across this country have formulated some sort of idea that they have to rise up against the wealthy because they've been treated, in part, not according to what they feel is fair. Now, what do people assume to be fair? Everyone, of course, is entitled to their own opinion, and people have freedom of choice, but we can certainly say that according to the Noahide standards of justice and economic well-being, all echelons of society, there is what to complain about. Alan, your take on these matters.
Well, yeah, it's talking about the rod. The whole class system and the system of injustice, people don't realize how much our legal system, our justice system, is based on the Roman legal system, which the Oral Torah equates with Edom. One of the things, and I was just looking at this, is the one of the symbols of Roman authority was the fasces. This is a bundle of sticks tied around an axe. This was the symbol that the fascists, in fact, they got the name from the fasces, used as the symbol of fascism. And sadly enough, it's even on a lot of our monuments in part of our legal history. If you look, like the Lincoln Memorial, I don't know if you've noticed, but that great statue of Lincoln sitting in the chair, his arms mm-hmm. are resting on two carved fasces. And in the president's State of the Union address, if you look at it, you will see the symbols of the fasces behind the president.
Uh-huh.
Right there in the house. I mean, this is a very symbolic of Roman rulership, where the rich do rule the poor. You know, we do have a class problem. That's been one of the major problems of violence, as you pointed out earlier, in Western civilization. And this is something that the Torah can definitely alleviate. You know, if we teach a social system and a justice system that does not have a class structure to it, because the Romans were the ones that really developed the classes, you know, the upper, lower, middle class that we have today. They were the ones that really developed it, and we've been trying to figure a way to get out of that, around it. And again, if with Torah education, that's the only way I see to get out of that.
Mm-hmm. Now, Alan, before I turn it around, what was that word, fasces?
Fasces, yes.
How do you spell it in English?
F-A-S-C-E-S.
Wow, it sounds like related to the word of fascism and feces, which I guess,
well,
I guess those things...
Same thing. But that's where the word fascism... That's the word that fascism came from. And
yeah.
it, like I said, it was a Roman. It was actually a Roman tool for a portable tool for decapitation. It's a bundle of it's an axe with a bundle of sticks tied around the axe handle.
Hmm.
And like I say, we here in America, we use that very symbol, the Roman symbol of decapitation, of authority, of punishment. That's one of the symbols we have traditionally used in our country.
Well, I think next time after the show, I want to take a look at a picture of the Lincoln Monument to look for the as you mentioned, the portrayal of the feces. I mean the fasces.
Yes.
Sorry, excuse me.
they're right there. They're right there on the armrests of the chair in the very front. If you
wow.
look at it from a head-on perspective, he's resting his hands on the fasces right there. Boom.
Wow.
And,
Ron,
and look up
on...
some of the old State of the Union addresses too. You'll see them behind the president.
Okay, I'll have to look for it. Ron, oppression. I mean, I don't know what you experienced in Guyana. What type of class system? I know you when you grew up, it was communist. So perhaps it was theoretically supposed to be a classless system. But you know, while everyone's supposed to be equal, some people are more equal than others. Your take on what you experienced in Guyana from what you can recall and what you've seen since you've come into America is where there has been an unrest, and it's a deep unrest amongst the masses now because they feel like they're not being treated, which I would say subconsciously, because the human soul really longs to see a society which is running according to the quality education which can provide the implementation of the 7 Noahide Commandments.
Okay, okay. In Guyana, we weren't completely communist at the time. We were actually still socialists, and people who were wealthy, and there were people who were poor. The problem was that, you know, if you look at the whole Bolshevik thing, where it was the masses who really didn't develop the country, took over the entire country, and we saw the results of it today. Home, we didn't get to that point. The thing is, we didn't have the wealthy didn't display their wealth the way it's displayed here in America. And many times I feel the display of wealth causes an envy and a craving desire of those who do not have to acquire it. Then we see, you know, how the way in which they live, what they do sometimes. I mean, when they do that which is wrong, of course, it's, you know, blatantly, you know, unacceptable. But when they just display their wealth, it creates that desire of those who do not have to either go out against them in terms of getting it somehow legally or even just stealing it from them. Back home, it was more hidden. People did not display their wealth. We knew they were wealthy, but it was never in the eyes of the public. And the thing is, here in America, you are basically, I think they dangle that in the eyes of the masses to keep running for that and to keep the masses going. The problem is now the masses really, they're not in the mood to go for it anymore. They just, you know, want to acquire it without that type of chasing system where we're chasing after the dollar every day. Because we want to acquire, we want to live like these people. Because it's in our eyes, day and night, on the television, in the news, everywhere we turn, we see, oh, the wealthy can do this, they can do that. The rest of the population can't afford it. So I think the display of wealth, besides the abuse of wealth, which is blatantly wrong and has to be eradicated, the whole display of it, brings upon a community or a society that. I don't know, because even in the times of the temple, there were wealthy people.
That's right.
There were poor people. There will always be wealthy people. There will always be poor people. But the way in which it's handled, I think that's what's important.
True. Well, under the Torah society of antiquity, and I'm not exactly sure how this would apply in terms of, quote-unquote, taxation within a Noahide society being properly run, I think the average Israelite, aside from a Kohen or a Levi, would have to give up almost about 22, maybe even up to 23% of his net profit. And, you know, because again, that was an agricultural society, so they weren't necessarily giving in cash, but in terms of portions of their produce. And there were certain years that precisely the produce was set, the excess produce was set aside for the poor. But again, there were always means by which the poor would be supported. And again, that's when Israel had sovereignty on their own land. I'd like to, gentlemen, go to this verse, if we see that a child is trained according to his or her way, even when he or she grows old, he or she will not turn away from it. We're talking about a person now who has been blessed. And what has this person been blessed with? King Solomon says, "He who has a generous eye will be blessed, for he gave of his bread to the poor." The Ibn Ezra explains, "In contrast to the one who seeks to rule over the poor and exploit them,
He has a generous heart and gives of his bread to the poor will be blessed and be replete with God's blessings. Now, bread alludes to many things, blessed souls. Again, in the oral Torah tradition, bread is not just simply throw people an extra slice of Wonder Bread, even whole wheat bread or sprout bread or gluten-free bread, whatever you want to give another person, rice bread, oat bread. We're talking about to nourish other human beings with what they need on a physical level, if it's possible. And we have wondrous food banks and organizations like City Harvest here in New York City, and I hope they have, there are places like that all over the country and around the world for that matter. But Torah is also likened to bread. In particular, bread is likened to the learning of the Talmud. And again, the Talmudic teachings which relate to the 7 9 commandments must go out into the atmosphere of human consciousness if we are to ensure a quality education, because without the Talmudic tractate, say, of, say, like Sanhedrin, and I'm sure Alan will comment, that, you know, we're really basically postulating these 7 9 commandments, because you really need this, the oral Torah tradition to bring home that which with which Noah and his three sons were blessed upon leaving the ark after that ancient flood over 4,100 years ago. So, Alan, this perspective where King Solomon is saying, if you want to see blessings in your life as someone who is rich in terms of Torah knowledge or someone who is economically well off, to access God's blessing would be to give with a generous eye. And I don't see that really being promoted in our current educational system.
No, it's not being promoted either in our educational system or in our popular media. The whole, you know, for the last 100 years, all this thing about prosperity and buying more stuff, that has been pushed on us. You know, spend. You know, anytime you watch television, read a magazine, they're always trying to sell you stuff that you should step back and say, do I really need this? You know, so much of the world looks at our culture as just being over-the-top materialistic, and in a sense we are. I know back in the 50s, at the height of American hegemony, we had 7% of the world's population and 50% of the world's wealth. The figures are not as much now, of course, but we still have a comparatively a large amount of wealth, goods. You know, I mean, you look at the poor in this country, the poor in this country is the envy of, you know, probably over half the Earth's population. You know, poor people have TVs, cell phones, you know, and there's so many people around the world who are living in huts.
Right.
I know in Haiti, during, you know, some of the severe crises they've encountered the past decade or two, you know, you had kids who were making mud cookies to eat because there was no food. And it's really hard to teach. Again, it's hard to try to educate people when they're starving. When you're suffering from severe economic hardship, education kind of takes a back seat. So there are a lot of things like that have to be addressed for people, you know, for the system, in order for it to get the education out there.
Mm-hmm. Ron?
Yeah, at this time I'd like to promote the whole food industry, whole food grocery industry, because they're constantly promoting small farms in a sustainable fashion all over the world, and they're going out there and they're trying to promote organic growth. They're actually buying the produce. They're in charge of the whole shipping and getting it here to America, and they're giving out loans to sustain these small farms. And women also, in terms of the countries where they're not so much in farmers, but they're weavers in parts of India, part of the Middle East, where women, you know, they're not physically strong to go out and farm, but they're their method of bringing in an income is weaving, and they have all these women there, you know, producing because they have a market. Because America, even though being a market, in those countries, a lot of times it's controlled by cartels and people who just want to be wealthy, and these people are basically enslaved by them. What this company is trying to do is go and meet these people directly to let them know that there's a future ahead. There's an open road. When you work, you will acquire. You're not just working, you're not being enslaved. Because majority of these third world countries, many of them, I know for sure, in South America, they're overrun by the drug trade. Because people realize, okay, you know, cocaine is going to flow from Colombia into this country. We're going to have it. We're going to send it to America and we get wealthy. Problem is, the amount of violence and crime that follows with this, it's unimaginable. I've heard that, you know, people that I've known back home got decapitated, basically on the street, so that people should know that, you know, don't violate the rules of the cartel. And we have tremendous amounts of agricultural land. We have minerals. The problem is recently, because of prices, Europe has decided to use beet sugar instead of cane sugar. And as a result, our sugar agriculture in Guyana that basically just fell because people cultivate it, they harvest it, and then basically the open market says we don't really need it and they don't get paid.
Right.
So the farms are... A lot of agricultural communities in my country are collapsing. And as these countries get collapsed, they get destabilized in terms of, you know, the inflation. And eventually the drug trade starts, you know, raising its head. It's offered to them. And they just go ahead with this because it's easy. It actually brings money. And, so it's happening in a lot of the South American and even flowing into the Caribbean islands right now. And they depend on Europe, depend on developed countries in terms of buying their products. This is how they get the, you know, the constant transfer.
I hear you. Now, part of this process of universal quality education will be, if we take it as a given, that part of the quality universal education will include educating people with the right, the freedom of choice to learn about the seven holy commandments. And as I just mentioned earlier, this would have to bring us to share with the world, whether we be Jews or Bnei Noach, the Talmudic teachings from the Tractate of Sanhedrin, which is the oral Torah tradition of how to administrate, to implement, to adjudicate cases and make society a just one. It's not about the law, it's about the justice which comes out of the law. You know, unfortunately, people confuse law with justice, but not all laws are just. But what this might do is it might raise arouse the anger, of individuals who say are of different faith-based belief systems, or religions, as you might want to call it. And Alan wrote a book, which I mentioned I wanted to promote it, and it's a book I would heavily promote, and I'm going to heavily promote, and hopefully in future sessions, though, we'll talk about this book, Alan, and Ron, if you haven't heard about it, I'll let you know about it. Now, it's called The Noahide Code, A Guide to the Perplexed Christian, Alan W. Cecil. In Chapter 2, talks about the idea of the Christian Talmud. Now, Alan, you mentioned here on page 47 that when debating other religions, Christians will invariably use questions from the New Testament to back up their Gnostic theology. The only text that the Christian will allow the Noahide to use is the Tanakh, which is the teachings of the prophets and the holy writings like Psalms and Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, or what Christians call the Old Testament. The Talmud, according to the Christians, is not scripture as the Christians define it, since it is not part of their Christian Bible. Rather, they say it is rabbinic interpretations and orally transmitted teachings written down at the end of the 2nd century Common Era. Thus, according to Christians, it is not on the same level as the New Testament because the teachings of the rabbis simply do not have the same authority as the teachings of Jesus. To the Noahide, it's a simple matter of what constitutes scripture to whom the authority has been given. From the Noahide perspective, the books of the New Testament are simply oral traditions written around the same time as the Talmud, and the Gnostic interpretations of the New Testament text are what make up Christian theology. So my first question, Alan,
and for you to come in as Jesus, they called him a rabbi. So those who call themselves Christians today in the modern sense, or say they're first Christians, so to speak, or Jews, they were simply pledging their allegiance to a different rabbinical interpretation, and as you assert here, to a different oral tradition, which is basically all the Talmud is an oral tradition giving us a historical instructive perception of how the Jews of almost 2,000 years ago, 1,700 years ago, were trying to preserve the traditions going back to Moses, and also preserving the traditions went back to Noah and his generation, going all the way back to Adam and his wife, Eve. Your comments on these matters.
Well, you know, that was the thing that I wrote, even on the back cover of the book. You know, people will say, well, oral traditions aren't as authoritative. And I point out, well, what kind of traditions did they have in the book of Bereshit? You know, the Torah wasn't written down for a long time. You know, how did Noah know in Bereshit in chapter 7, verse 2? He knew the difference between kosher and non-kosher animals. It doesn't say anything about what animals are kosher. Nothing was written down. How did he know that? You know, why were the people of Sodom guilty? Why was the generation of the flood? I mean, you know, it was so obvious that there was a right and a wrong for mankind, a moral code, and it had not been written down, yet it was there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only transmitted through oral traditions, oral teachings. And this is where the importance of the oral Torah comes in. And for the Noahide law is only laid out in the oral Torah. So that is where we have to go. And this is the problem that you have. Like you say, that's exactly the point. You know, the Christians just have a different rabbi, or rabbis. They call Paul a rabbi, too. He wasn't a very good one, from my humble perspective. But they give them authority, but what authority do they have intrinsically? Not any. I mean, you can pick and choose what rabbi you want to follow. Well, I follow an Ashkenaz rabbi. I follow a Sephardic rabbi. You know, we do our prayers a little different, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
You know, it's whoever you give the authority to. And that is something that a lot of people have a hard time grasping. Just because you have a title, it's the same thing with the doctor. You know, this guy you're going and seeing might have a DR in front of his name, Dr. So-and-so, but, you know, is he a real doctor or is he a quack? You know, both the
right.
quacks and the real doctors have doctor in front of their name, and you have to,
right.
you know, who do you give the authority to?
Right. Ron, your take on these matters, how it is crucial, if we're going to talk about a quality education, is to educate people that, and you know, this is not something which is foreign to the human family experience. The Native American Indians have their own oral tradition. The Africans have their own oral tradition. So why should the world be put off by the fact that we of Israel and we of the B'nai Noah have an oral Torah tradition? So it was written down, okay, because there are reasons for that as well. But again, if we look at prophecy, which so many people believe in, what was prophecy? An oral transmission written down from God to the prophet, or an oral transmission of basically that to a prophet or prophets. And it boggles my mind. Well, when people hear the word oral tradition, they can accept other oral traditions. But when it comes to the oral tradition of Israel, as it relates to really implementing a quality education, without being part and parcel of the 7 Ark Commandments, they get it ruffles their feathers. Your take on these matters?
I think from a simple understanding, people attribute kind of a, I don't know if it's the right word, but for the lack of the right word, a divinity to the people of the Bible. And when they think of all the elders, the people in the time of the Talmud, they equate them with just being men, regular average human beings whose minds can change or interpret things according to their understanding, or that would be
right.
comfortable or beneficial to them. And I think that is the thing, because the whole idea of Jesus to supersede Moses and all the other prophets and everyone, you know, before him, they give him an upper
kind of divinity of being God's son above. That's why his words take precedence over all the others.
Mm-hmm.
Because we see constant discrepancies. Oh, this is God's son. So it's the son. Oh, he got it directly from the Father. Some Christian denominations even kind of say he is God in the embodiment of a man, Chas v'Shalom. So that's why they give him such a position of superiority over everything else. So I think that's what happens. You know, you hear Rashi or Rama, who is this guy? Oh, he left it this time. But you hear Moses, you hear Abraham. Oh, these guys were, didn't realize it on the level of who we are today. Those were the people then. They were human beings doing things that the Creator commanded, and this is the reason why they have risen to the levels they have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hear you. Okay, gentlemen, I'd just like to conclude with three. I'm sort of recapitulating a teaching from Babbage Rebbe in a letter that he wrote in 1970. And the other day, Alan, you heard this in its more pristine form, but I want to universalize it as part of, this UN noble goal of quality education. Number one, if we are going to provide a quality education for human beings, it should be predicated on the option given to all human beings to learn Torah and to learn about the commandments that are relevant to them, the commandments that are relevant between man and man, not to steal, not to kill, not to commit adultery, and serving Creator by avoiding serving idols and avoiding blaspheming the Creator. And the way in which we encourage people to study should be with true inspiration. They should feel vitalized by such teachings. And they should permeate the totality of the person in his or her daily conduct. Number two is to include into a quality universal education for all human beings is loving your neighbor as yourself, again, with the utmost vitality and to the fullest measure. And the third thing to integrate into a universal form of education, quality education for all the nations here in this generation, is looking kindly and respectfully towards other human beings who have declared the fact that they want to engage in this type of study, engage in these type of commandments. But even if their approach is different than ours, we should approach them out of love and reverence for the fact they've made the notable decision to integrate that into their own personal life decision and use their influence to integrate it into their own personal societies. So the question is, Alan, do you think this is something that, at least in talking about it and bringing it to the table of human discussion, we can hopefully pray and bless for those who are hearing us live or the future archive version, that they can share this with other people to try to bring this into the human table of discussion?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, this is a major point I emphasize and have emphasized for many years, is that education is the key to this. You have to educate people to what the Torah is about, what the Noahide Law is about, to get them to understand how important and how vital this knowledge is, to bring this into an entire educational curriculum. And that has been one of the major problems of our society, is we have deliberately excluded Torah from our academic system. I mean, even in our colleges and universities, they study all different types of religion, but they don't teach the Torah. They'll have classes in the quote-unquote Old Testament, but it is always from a Christian perspective.
Mm-hmm. Ron, you take on these matters.
I agree heavily with Alan's that, because I've noticed it coming from a different culture, where, you know, even the mentioning of God's name, people saying, God will help you. It's not something used here. I mean, we were amazed by the fact that on American money it says, "In God we trust." But I think it begins and ends there, and it may be just to acquire money. But in reality, it's not commonplace to mention the name of God in anything here. And I think it it can start with even with us every day when we converse, talk to people, anyone we react with, to mention God's name, you know. And I think just by just constantly mentioning the name, I think we will kind of, we can kind of bring about an awareness that, you know, don't forget, there's God, you know. Yes, we should have a good weekend, yes, but you know what? By the will of God. And people, I think it starts to sensitize us to this type of atmosphere again. And I think on my level, I think that's what that's my starting point of bringing the creative into, you know, everyday conversations. Yeah.
Thank you. And that starting point, Ron, is where we're going to make an ending point. I'd like to thank both you, Ron, and you, Alan, and you, Alan, and you, Ron, for using one of your most valuable resources, your precious time, to join with me for the past 70 minutes plus. We've spilled over. That's okay. We're program and produce the show where we can spill over a little bit. And before we sign off and before we segue out with the wonderful music using just the human voice of Rav Yosef Kadorner in chanting out Psalms 121, Sher Malos, is there anything else you'd like to share with us, Alan, before we sign off today?
Build your library. do what Rashi said, acquire books. There's so much wonderful literature, commentary, teachings on the Torah out there. You really should emphasize that, you know, instead of... I want to buy that new pair of shoes or a new upgrade my television or get a new iPhone. Think about getting some really good books on Torah.
Beautiful. Amen. Ron, any pieces of advice you'd like to share with our Blessed Soul audience today, Soul Class audience?
You're never too old to learn something new, and it's always time to upgrade to Torah knowledge.
Amen. That being said, Blessed Souls, we're going to end off with Yosef Kaduner's Sher Malos, A Song of Ascents. I'll just read it in English before we segue out with the Hebrew chanting of this beautiful music, just using his beautiful human voice. Blessed voice, A Song of Ascents, I shall raise my eyes to the mountains, from where will my help come? My help is from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. He will not allow your foot to falter, your guardian will not slumber. Behold, the garden of Israel, neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is your guardian, the Lord is your shadow, he is by your right hand. By day the sun will not smite you, nor the moon at night. The Lord will guard you from all evil, he will guard your soul. The Lord will guard your going out and your coming in from now into eternity. And before we sign off, I just want to remind everyone, reminding myself, reminding Alan, reminding Ron, anyone who's listening or will be listening to the archive version, you have got to be good, because the Teva Tov Lahati, the nature of the good is to do good. And since you're living upon this blessed human, not human earth, God's earth, the Creator's earth, the Ein Sof's earth, the infinite Creator, you therefore are empowered. It's just a matter of accessing what is truly within you, that goodness of a Teva Tov Lehetiv. And that being said, may this manifest in our lives in a peaceful and pleasant manner. Dachinam Dachi Shalom, Bahavachad, one love, Goralachad, one destiny, Kulan of worlds, Bedachinam Dachi Shalom, in a peaceful and pleasant way, Lahamshik. La Hamshik, but Ezra Shem Yisrael, to be continued with the help of the Most High. Take care of everyone.
Shir la ma'alot, esa einay el harim, me'ayin yavo ezri, ezri me'im ha'ashem, ose shamayim va'aret. אל ייתן למות רגליך, אל ינום שומריך. הנה לא ינום, ינום ולא ישן, שומר ישראל. השם שומריך, השם צילך, על יד ימינך. יומם השמש לא יקקה, וירח בלילה, השם ישמורך מכל רע, ישמור את נפשך, השם ישמור צאתך ובואך, מעתה ועד עולם.
Hashem ishmor tzedcha uboera, me'ata ve'ad olam. Hashem ishmor tzedcha uboera, me'ata.